Welcome back, Rocky Road family. We have a new guest for you here today. She is a self-proclaimed author, speaker, lover of people, and black licorice. I'm going to invite her to introduce herself. So, hey there, Kim. How are you? Tell us just a tiny bit about who you are.
Thank you, Kristen, Mandy. Nice to see you guys. I started my first business right out of high school. So I'm an entrepreneur. I have been my whole life. I've sold most of my businesses recently. So a little bit of freedom in my life, which is kind of nice. And I have kids and grandkids and a new puppy and living the dream, as they say, I guess.
Yeah. In speaking with Mandy and preparing to speak with you today, I said, well, there's about 40 different highways we could go down here because you have a lot of depth to a lot of different areas of your life. And so I have a couple of questions, but if this is more of a free form conversation about your journey and what you've been through and how you are still smiling every single day, then that's what we're going to go with. So my first question would be for you, you are an author. Tell us, what are you writing?
Well, my first book, I started writing right after I was diagnosed with cancer. And I went to the bookstore and everything was either very medical or very depressing. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want to know what it feels like. I want to know, are there choices I have to make? Are there things that I need to know? What do I need to do? And so I started writing then and kept writing. And 4 months after I was diagnosed, my husband was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and passed away 6 weeks after that. And so I was still writing during that whole time. I wrote for about a year, and that is my first book, Cry Until You Laugh, because I think that's what you need to do, cry when you need to cry, but you need to be able to laugh again. Mm-hmm. And then losing my husband made me question what love really is, if I was doing it right. I had a great marriage, a wonderful man, but I wanted to know that the rest of my life, being widowed at 47, was completely unexpected. And it shouldn't happen to anybody. You know, you're supposed to grow old together, be that couple sitting in rockers on the front porch, sipping lemonade, looking at each other, whatever couples do in the front porch, sipping lemonade in their 90s. But so I wanted to figure it out. So I dedicated a year, a full year. It actually took me a little bit longer than a year. I guess I'm a slow learner. But I dedicated the time to figuring out the true meaning of love. And that is my second book, Love Is.
Mm-hmm. So I love the title of your first book, Cry Until You Laugh, because it's usually the opposite where you laugh until you're crying, and to twist it around like that. And I was wondering, because full disclosure, I haven't gotten the opportunity to read either of your books yet, but I'm wondering if, even looking at the title, did anybody think that you were taking a little bit of a lighthearted look at something as difficult as cancer and trauma and losing your husband, or was it pretty well received?
Well, it's been well received. I think there's a lot of humor in both of my books. Even my love book, it's not like some serious rainbows and unicorns, you know, kind of a book. But there's a lot of depth to it. Like, the things I learned about love just blew my mind. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Cry Until You Laugh. You know, one of the first things people would say to me when they found out I had cancer is, "Why you? You know, why you?" And my response was always, well, why not me? Why would I be immune? You know, why? Nobody's immune. It could happen to anybody at any time. And so it's not like I believe that there's, you know, some being in the sky that smites us that goes, oh my gosh, I saw you steal that pack of gum in seventh grade. And so when you're 47, you're getting cancer. It's all over for you. But I don't think that happened.
And there's not a tally mark on the wall that you have to answer for.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I just think people need permission to laugh. You know, I've known so many people who tend to stay in the sorrow, and at some point in time, you got to open the door again. Mm-hmm. And you know, the whole saying, "Get over it." You know, you just got to move on. I don't like either one of those things, because you never get over it. Mm-hmm. You never forget who you've lost. You never forget. You never get over it. There's nothing to get over, but you can smile and laugh again. And sometimes people need permission to do that. Like they feel like it's disrespectful to be happy again, like dishonoring somehow. They just stay in some grief mode. But to me, I think it's honoring to laugh again. it's honoring to live fully. It shows that they meant something to you, that you want to honor them in that way.
Kristen's like, I have so many questions to ask you and ready to jump the gun. And I think, you know, what I'm listening to and hearing is we talk about this a lot in on our podcast is just the cycle of grief and having that all this anger and the acceptance and the denial and everything that comes along with it. And then eventually you do get to that point. And I think everybody can relate at some point in your life, you hit a point where you're not laughing or you're not smiling. Whether that's for a week, whether that's for months, whether that's for years. So I love that you put that together saying, give permission to people to smile and to laugh, and that it does honor their loved ones and people that they've lost, whether that's a relationship or a death. It does give you that permission to still enjoy life with what you do have here. But my question for you is, you had cancer and then your husband got diagnosed. So I think when we face trials like that, we face our mortality so head on and just what is happening in our lives, that our life can be gone so quickly. So walk me through that experience for you. You were still battling cancer when your husband got diagnosed, or had you been already in remission?
I was still in my cancer journey. And when I received a phone call on a Friday afternoon, I expected if I ever was diagnosed with cancer, which I never expected to be, but sure, if I ever was, it would be one of those lifetime moments where you're sitting across the desk from the doctor and you and your spouse are holding hands and you're just kind of huddled together. And then the doctor says, I have news for you, one of those moments. And instead, I get this phone call on a Friday afternoon saying, blah, 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 you have cancer. We'll call you on Tuesday. I'm like, what just happened? It was like this smack, like I ran into this wall, got hit by a truck. I mean, I didn't even know what to say. I knew nothing at the moment. I knew absolutely nothing. It was late in the day. I couldn't call back. So I just was left for the weekend with nothing. And that was traumatic, hearing those words for anybody, no matter how it happens. It's like, oh my, because we all know people who have had cancer and not come around from it, not been able to overcome it. And so that's where my head went right away is I've got young grandbabies and I've got kids and, my husband and what am I supposed to do? And didn't know anything. And then a couple weeks into my diagnosis, my husband started having these stomach pains and he went to the doctor and they said, oh, just take some Tums. It's just because your wife has cancer, whatever. Well, 2 months later, he went again and the doctor said the same thing. I really don't think it's anything, but I'll set up an appointment for you at a gastro guy. And so he set up an appointment for 2 months later. And the day my husband went to the gastro person, I had surgery the next day. I was having a complete hysterectomy because of the kind of breast cancer that I had. And I was also having a colonoscopy. So anyone who's done that and has had fun with the cleanse realizes that you do not leave your bathroom, right? Like I couldn't go with them to the appointment. Yeah. And so, and I'm the mouth. And he's just, goes along with it and whatever. And he came home and said, they told him the same thing. Take some Tums. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Are you serious? We waited this long for an appointment and that's what they told you. They didn't run a test. They did nothing. So a week later, he was awake before I was and he just was in pain. And I said, that's it. Go to the ER. And I was still recovering from my surgery. I was still in, pants with elastic, relaxing at home and watching Grey's Anatomy reruns. And so he drove himself to the ER and he was a rule follower and it said no cell phones. So he did not have his phone on as I'm waiting for a phone call. And he finally called and said, I guess they're going to keep me overnight. And I'm like, what? They don't keep anybody overnight. What are you talking about? And so I put on real people clothes and then I got in my car and drove like a bad out of howling, my Vicodin-induced state to the hospital. And shortly before I got there, my phone rang again. And he said, I guess there's a spot on my liver. I'm like, spot on your liver? You got to be kidding. And so I'm bawling. And I get there and somehow park and hold every part of my body as I'm running in the door to find out where he is, and found out he was behind this curtain. And I'm sobbing, and I whip back the curtain, and he's just sitting on the edge of the bed like nothing's going on. And I'm sobbing. And he said, listen, I am not going to invite you out anymore if this is the way you're going to behave. And I said, listen, buddy, you are not allowed to be funny right now.
Is he typically the funny one? Is that typically the type of reaction that he would give to things?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. We had some fun banter always, for sure. But it took a few days for him to get a diagnosis. And holy cow, you know, you'd think after you hear one diagnosis that you go, well, you know, I know how to handle the next one. Right. But it's not. It wasn't that way. It was like, you got to be kidding. And pancreatic cancer of all things. So,
One diagnosis came in one way, and the other diagnosis came in a totally different way. And so they're both two very traumatic ways that you find out that you have cancer, but they're very different. And that really impacts you and changes your life in seconds.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I was in denial. I was in denial for me. Like, I had a biopsy and I'm like, whatever, there's no cancer in my family. I mean, I fought even going to get a mammogram because I'm like, well, whatever, I'm wasting my time. Mm-hmm. And then I was in denial for my husband. They ran blood work, and there's cancer markers in your blood. And his numbers were out of control, like just extremely high. I happened to be reading The Last Lecture. I don't know if you know that book or not, but I was reading that at the time. And
yeah, I do.
So I just read his numbers in the book, and my husband's were much greater. And I thought, what? And I said, well, something's wrong with the lab. You know, something must have happened, because if you've never seen numbers like this before, you know, they blew it. You need to run them again, you know, whatever. And it took me a while to actually settle in and realize that that he had this cancer.
And what year was that?
That was in 2009.
Okay. Gotcha. So it's been about, what, 14, 15 years since he passed away?
Yep. It'll be 14 in March. Yeah.
Wow. That's a long time to be without someone.
And, it is.
Yeah.
It is. And it's a reinvention, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I saw my life one way, and then everything changed. And
without your permission.
Without my permission. No kidding. I plan things, you know, like a vacation. I'm going to know the tickets and when we leave and where we're staying and what we're doing. And I thought I had it planned out. And so everything changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have never personally heard of two people battling cancer together at the same time. But I have a family member who had a similar thing happen too, where, you know, you have these dreams of retirement and these dreams of living the dream together. And then all of a sudden that dream does change overnight in one phone call or one doctor visit, which is really scary. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure now from where you are at 14, almost 14 years later to where you are then, you're such a different person. And I'm sure you've changed in a lot of ways and grown. So can you walk us through that journey of that diagnosis, that traumatic year, I would say, that you had, and where you are now?
Yeah, well, I still had to go through stuff after losing my husband. And I kind of put things on hold after he was diagnosed. And we were told he'd live probably a year or so. And so 6 weeks was incredible. And our prayer from the beginning was, you know, either heal him, like, you know, a miraculous healing, like the blind, the deaf, the lame, or I believe in heaven, you know, the ultimate healing of heaven, but please don't let him suffer. And that's exactly, our prayer was answered, because he did not suffer. We had this great 6 weeks together watching Cash Cab and playing Rummy, you know, whatever, and hanging out. And his pain was very well managed. We had great hospice, Faith Hospice. They were wonderful and did a great job. And then he woke up on a Sunday morning and he was in pain. And it really was the first time that his pain was not managed. And I called the hospice nurse and she came right over. And the night before we had dinner together and we were playing Pictionary. Actually, we had some people over and then, you know, he woke up the next morning feeling miserable and he was sitting on the edge of the bed and I was just holding him from behind because he was sort of rocking, like I could just feel his pain. And the hospice nurse upped his morphine, said, you know, whatever. And she's on the phone in my bedroom calling for a hospital bed and whatever. And I said, do I call my kids? What do I do? And, no, you got lots of time. You got lots of time. No worries. You know, you don't have to call your kids. And I said, are you sure? Because he's miserable. No, really, it's okay. So she's on the phone and I'm just holding him and I could feel his intense pain. I could just feel his misery. And so I just whispered in his ear, I said, baby, just go. And that was it. He didn't take another breath after that. That was the end.
Wow.
And it was such a merciful way to go because he did not suffer. And, you know, for him, it was good. You know, it was really good. Hard for me, but great for him. And so it was a shock, but not a shock. Like we knew it was coming, just not that quickly.
Of course. And yeah.
Especially because he'd been doing so good.
That's interesting what you say about the hospice nurses saying that there's more time. Because I think in my experience, hospice nurses have the best intuition of every, like they can down to the hour, they can say you probably have about another day. Or they, you know, like with my Nana, like it's almost a sixth sense in a way where they really have been through it so much that they know the timing and to show that was just, it transcended all of that logic and it was just, it needed to be that merciful. And that sounds like talking about it, it's interesting to hear you share that moment because so many people would describe it as one of the most difficult moments of their life. And you have a lightness to it because of the journey that you've taken in your healing and because you've been able to work through it in such a way. And I have the utmost respect for you being able to smile as you talk about a difficult moment because you realize the good and the mercy that he was shown in that moment. And so it's a very interesting difference in how people process things and how people go through their own experiences. And so this is leading up to me asking about, you've made an obvious decision. I'm going to choose joy. I'm going to choose laughter. I'm going to choose happiness. And so my head goes to, there are people out there who will never choose that. They will choose grief for their entire life. They will choose that darkness. They will choose to be, as you said, upset and bitter and just live in that darkness for so, so long. And so what would be your advice for anyone who you see who is either choosing that, or if I have someone in my life who is choosing that darkness, what would you tell me your advice would be to help them to crack a little bit of that shell and let a tiny bit of light in so that they can cry until they laugh?
Right. Yeah. I would say two things. One is I think people don't realize they're making that choice, that they have a choice. Mm. And so recognizing that you do have a choice, there's a lot of things that you'd never choose. You know, you wouldn't choose to lose somebody you love. You wouldn't choose to have cancer. You wouldn't choose to be widowed at 47. You know, there's so many things that you wouldn't choose that you have no control over. But there's a lot of things that you do have control over, like how you live and how much joy is in your life and how you react to whatever it is that life throws at you. And you do have a choice. So that's the first thing, is recognizing you do have a choice. You can be happy. You can choose to be happy. You can choose joy. And the other thing is, when I was finally ready to go back to work, at the end of I was healthy enough to go back to work. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I ended up committed to being part-time bookkeeper for a nonprofit organization that my father and I had started 10 years before and had a guy running. So January 1st of 2010, I became part-time bookkeeper and thought I'd figure out life. 12 days later, there was an earthquake in Haiti that killed 200,000 people. So within 2 weeks, I went from part-time bookkeeper to 24/7 full on. And then 2 weeks later, I was boots on the ground in Haiti. And then for the next several years, at least part of every month, I was in Haiti. And I learned that service is the greatest grief healer. When you can get out of yourself and serve others, when you can help others with their pain, it is the greatest healer. It's the greatest healer. And I'd never heard that before. I had no idea. It just kind of something that worked out in my life to do. And I don't think everybody has to go to Haiti. There's places to serve right next door, you know, right in your own city. You don't have to go, but to serve, to get out of yourself, get out of your own head, I think is very healthy.
I love that answer.
I love that answer too. And I totally agree with that. And I also think that it's amazing, really, the courage that you had after the trauma that you had gone through with phone calls and then your own cancer treatments and the loss of your husband, to make that decision so quickly in 2 weeks to go and help. And that's a decision that only comes from strength within, because people that are drowning in grief and people that are still learning to accept the loss of a relationship or a person or a friendship can get stuck and paralyzed almost. So that movement of making that decision really helps to, it just really encourages me. And it really shows, it's just an inspiration as far as the courage that you had. And you can speak into this more. Do you think because of the trauma and the things that you had endured, do you think that's, it gave you really that, that courage to go do that? Had you not gone through your cancer journey and your husband's journey, do you think you would have made that same decision prior?
I don't think I would have, because I resigned from my position. I was running a nonprofit and resigned from that because I was diagnosed with cancer. Mm-hmm. And so now I had this clean slate of life that to figure out, you know, like the sky was the limit. Like I could do whatever it is that I wanted to do, work at an ice cream store, but that would be dangerous for me because I like ice cream.
So do I.
But I could do whatever I wanted, you know, whatever I could figure out to do. And then because I didn't have my husband at home, who I would want to be with all the time, I had the freedom to be gone as much as I was gone. And so it definitely, changed everything. It definitely did. And, you know, it's funny because for years I thought, gosh, if my husband walked through the door right now, it would not surprise me. It would seem natural. Like he should just walk through the door. And so there were definitely times that I thought, oh, I got to call him and tell him I'm leaving tomorrow. Or, oh, I got to let him know, you know, I got to make sure he's all set with whatever. And I got to call him, you know, I'm in Haiti. I should call home. And there's this, you know, like this emptiness, this void that slowly, this like hole in my heart, I guess, that slowly healed so that I can go home from work without thinking I got a call and say I'm going to be a little late, you know, because I'm not going home to anybody. There's nobody to call. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I think the experience certainly helped. The fact that I had this new life and had to figure it out helped. And I think, you know, you go through something, you have to have courage.
Yeah.
You have to have courage to get through it. You got to believe, you got to be strong. You've got to face it. You know, you've got to have courage. And I think people have a lot more courage than they realize. You know, they think that how can they possibly do it? Well, you know what? You did it. You're doing it. You're doing it. It takes courage to put one foot in the front of the other sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I want to dig into love with you, because I know that is your specialty. And I know that this is a word and a topic and a feeling that is misunderstood by a lot of people. The definition of love is different, I think, for every single person. Every single person's experiences of love are so different, how they give it, how they receive it. We could go in so many different directions with this, but I want to ask you personally, how do you give and how do you receive love personally in your life?
Well, you know, in doing this journey that I did, I discovered so many things about love that I thought were true that weren't. And it changed how I love and it changed how I receive love. Mm-hmm. And so it was one way before and it's another way now. And some of it has taken some practice because, you know, like love that is patient took me a lot of practice. But anyway, one of the things that we hear about love is that it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. We hear that, right? Or people will put a number to it. It's 50-50, mm-hmm. it's 100-100. Well, love doesn't have a number. Love is not mm-hmm. an emotion like fear or excitement. You know, we don't live in fear. Everything's not the Halloween movie series, you know, or we don't live in excitement. You know, every day is not Disney World, but you live in love. Love is who you are. Love is walking, talking, living, breathing, giving. It's who you are. And so the whole that it's a two-way street thing isn't true because you have no control over anybody. You have no control over anybody. You know, you have a baby, you bring the baby home from the hospital and you have complete control. You decide when the baby eats. You decide when the baby gets a bath. You decide when you put down the baby. Well, 6, 7, 8 months later, pretty soon, your Tupperware is all over your kitchen floor and pots and pans are banging everywhere. And you realize you have lost all control and you will never get it back again. You never will. We control nobody but ourselves. Nobody. So if you give love to get love in return, that's a transaction. If I give you money and you give me a pair of jeans, that's a transaction. Love is not a transaction. Mm. You have to give love, period. The minute you give it to get it, you set yourself up for all kinds of disappointment, all kinds of heartache. You don't give love to get love. You love, period. Love has this wonderful way of coming back to you. But if you're giving it to get it, then you're loving for completely the wrong reason, and that's not love at all.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you use that specific word because we have someone else who was a previous guest who talked about being vulnerable in relationships when being vulnerable is very hard. And he described it in just that way, where if you're not vulnerable and if you're not true to yourself, then it truly is a transactional relationship. And is it a relationship at all? And so I love that word because it is so dry. And we don't want to think of anything, any interaction that we have with someone, especially if it's supposed to be out of love, to be dry and empty and lifeless.
Right. Right. To be business. Right. Mm-hmm. Just be business. Nothing personal. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Nothing that really has anything to do with life.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. So, go ahead.
One question I have is, what are some of you had mentioned in the very beginning? What are some of the things that you had thought love was that you found out were untrue or were different than what you were told?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a big one, that love is not a transaction. There's not a number to love, you know, that's not a two-way street. Like that, mm-hmm. those were big. But another thing about love is the very first word out of the gate, you know, I used this 2,000-year-old poem and worked on a word each month. Love is patient, love is kind, does not envy, does not boast. And the very first word is love is patient. And so I thought, well, I know what patience is. You know what patience is. You're not honking your horn if you're stuck in traffic or mad because right. your son doesn't know where his shoes are and he's going to be late for school. But love that is patient is entirely different than that. Mm-hmm. And it's something I've had to practice a lot. But love that is patient, I believe you're just supposed to love everybody. It just is such the way to live. Just love everybody.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And love that is patient loves in a way that you recognize that this moment right here, right now is the most important moment of your life. What's in the past is in the past and what's in the future is yet to come. This is the moment. And I'll tell you, I thought I was the greatest multitasker in the world. Like I could think about who I had to get to soccer practice, what I had to pick up at the store on the way home at the grocery store, who I needed to get to play practice and a meeting that I had later and something that happened yesterday, while being fully engaged in conversation at the same time. And I realized I can't. I'm not that superwoman. I don't think that person exists. And so when I realized what love is patient is and put myself completely in the moment and gave myself completely 100% all of me to who I was talking to, my life changed dramatically. Because instead of assuming what somebody is going to say because of some label I put on them, which love has no labels, but because of who I think they are, instead of assuming, I'm actually hearing what people are saying. And when you really listen, your world opens up in a different way. Mm-hmm. And when you recognize that there are no labels, that we're all individuals, that it just changes everything when you just stop and really engage and really listen and appreciate people for who they are, and without your rebuttal ready, without anything, but just stop and listen. It changes everything, and that's love that is patient.
Yeah, I love that. I would love to know too for you. You mentioned the 2,000-year-old poem, and Kristen and I are both Christians openly on our podcast, and we share a lot about our journey and our faith. And what led you to that poem, to that research, I guess, behind what love is?
Well, when I started and I just started questioning love and really kind of thinking about it, praying on it, you know, in John it says that God is love. Mm-hmm. That God is love. It doesn't say God loves. Mm-hmm. It says God is love.
Yes.
So love is something you could be, which mm-hmm. was new to me. Like I never mm-hmm. looked at it that way before. Mm-hmm. And so then I thought, well, Paul wrote this roadmap basically, right? I mean, he wrote these is's and isn'ts of love, which there are 14 of them, which why it took me longer than a year to get it done. Right. But it just made sense to me to use that because it's right there in chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians. And
I have always, growing up with that, we hear that all the time at weddings. You know, you hear it sometimes once in a while at a funeral. I actually myself worked in hospice for a little while. So I attended many of my patients' funerals. And, you know, you hear it every once in a while, just somebody in they represent the word love well. And I think growing up, a lot of times I would hear, as I started learning more about it, to replace the word love is patient with Jesus's name. And that really is a characteristic of who we are as a person. So you can replace it with your name. So Mandy is patient. Mandy is kind. And then just kind of speaking that over yourself of what we should be and how we should embody ourselves and be with those around us. So tell me more about really how it's changed your interaction with people. So you come to know really what love is. What is maybe what's something that you would have done prior and now has changed because you've studied that passage of scripture, wrote a book, and all the things involved?
Well, with love, with real love, the love, the kind of love that God is, there is no room for judgment. There's no room for condemnation. There's no room mm-hmm. for racism. Love recognizes that we are all individual, all, you know, I think of like the Mona Lisa. If the Mona Lisa ever went up for sale, who knows how many millions and millions, somebody right. would pay for it, right? I mean, whoever yeah. would pay so much money for it. Well, it's because it's one of a kind. Mm-hmm. It's one of a kind. And so are you. You're one mm-hmm. of a kind. There's nobody that has ever been exactly like you. There's nobody mm-hmm. that ever will be exactly like you. You are unique and special mm-hmm. and made exactly the way you're supposed to be. This is how mm-hmm. you were created. You know, we tend to judge ourselves so harshly. I think especially as women, you know, absolutely, we look in the mirror, yeah. oh my gosh, you know, I was with these beautiful ladies today, Kristen and Mandy. I don't know that I really stack up to them. You know, like we do that to ourselves. Mm-hmm. Well, this is how I look. Because yeah. this is what God wanted for me. This is how I was created. Mm-hmm. And so to embrace your uniqueness, then love would say, love yourself and embrace that, embrace who you are. And while you do that, then you also see the uniqueness in others and you appreciate their uniqueness. And mm-hmm. and yeah. then it's not putting labels. Like I said, you know, you don't look at somebody and go, oh my gosh, there was a wrong political party. I don't know if I can even have a conversation with them. Well, you're putting a label on them. That's not who they are. It might be something that they believe in, but it's not who they are. It's not the depths of their soul, who they truly mm-hmm. are. And so So now I see people that way. I see people as just these beautiful, unique individuals who are all fascinating, who nobody has walked in the same pair of shoes, but we all walk on the same earth. Mm-hmm. So nobody is better than another. And just to embrace that about people changes how you look at people, changed how I look at people and see the beauty in everybody.
I love that because that's really why we started our podcast, that everybody has a story and everyone has a unique story. Nobody has walked through the journey that you have. No one has walked through the journey that I have, that Kristen has. And that's what makes us unique. And that's what makes us individuals. And I just love that too. You know, you can't say that because you went through something, you know exactly how someone else is feeling if they're going through something even similar. So your breast cancer journey looks very different than someone else's breast cancer journey, And the loss of your husband looks very different than the loss of someone else's husband, even by cancer. They look different. And so our goal is to give those platforms to allow people to share that space, that exactly what you said, you can be encouraged and you can look at somebody and know that they're unique and that they're beautiful and that they're meant for what they're meant for here on this same earth that we all walk on, but that we can relate to each other, but we're not exactly like each other. So I love that comparison, really.
And we don't have to fix anybody. Mm. It's not our job to fix anybody. You know, I was the queen, I think, of not just multitasking, I thought, but I was truly the queen of unsolicited advice. Mm. You know, how often, I can't even tell you, that I'd be in conversation with somebody and they're telling me their problem that they just want to tell me. They just want to talk. You know, a lot of times people just need to get something off their chest. They just need to talk. They just need a sympathetic ear. And, but I would be thinking of, oh, well, gosh, if they just did this, if they just did that, if they just did this. And, and it's not my job. You know, my only job is to love. You know, if somebody asks for advice, of course, I'll gently and cautiously give advice. But to offer it unsolicited, that's not love.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I think that's a great reminder that we all need, honestly.
Absolutely. Well, what I'm hearing from this too is that it seems like releasing your own expectations for other people and your expectations even for yourself sometimes and giving yourself grace allows you to love more fully, because if you just put it out and it's not received, okay, I'm going to keep putting it out and it's not received. Okay, I'm going to keep on doing what I'm doing. And maybe one day this one person might decide to receive my love. But if they don't, that's still okay. And I am still whole and a very loving person. Mm-hmm. So being able to take those expectations that you have or that other people have and be able to release them a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I love that word. You know, when I was early married, I got married young. And when I was early married, I had this evening that I thought, oh, I'm going to make my husband so happy. You know, I'm going to make his favorite meal. I'm going to put candles on the table and I'm going to make his favorite dessert and put on something a little sexy to greet him at the door. And so I couldn't wait for him to come home. Mm-hmm. And he got home and I greeted him at the door and he walked in. The place was spotless. You know, I cleaned our apartment and he walked in, didn't say a word, you know, just, hey, how are you? How was your day? You know, like nothing, like he's not noticing anything. And then we sit down to eat and he says nothing about the beautiful table that I set and the wonderful lasagna that I made. And I'm thinking, he's not saying anything. Like, it was making me mad that he was not acknowledging anything. So by the time it came to dessert and I made this German chocolate cake from scratch, and so it took a long time, right? I practically threw it at him. Because I was so mad by then, because I was like, why is he not, he's not saying a word, you know, not telling me I look at nothing. And he said, what's the matter with you? You know, why are you mad? And I said, well, I did all this and you've said absolutely nothing. And he said, wait a minute. He said, I've done nothing wrong. It's your expectations that are getting you in trouble. Mm-hmm. But I don't read minds. I cannot read your mind. So I didn't know you needed me to say those things. It's your expectations that are screwing things up right now. And I'm like, my expectations, who does he think he is telling me? He's not my father. Like, what are you trying to teach me a lesson? And as I, you know, slam the door to the bedroom and I just go in sulking and my expectations. And then I thought, oh, my expectations. He was right. Mm-hmm. He was right. He did nothing wrong. He really did nothing wrong. He was left-handed. And he said that's why he couldn't give compliments, that he wasn't good. I don't know if that's true, but that's what he always said.
I would kind of agree with that. I'm also left-handed. It's harder for me.
There you go. But it was my expectations. And love has no expectations. Love has no expectations. Love that is kind does kind things, is kind, shows kindness, says kind words because it loves, because of love, not expecting something in return. You know, I've heard people say, oh my gosh, they didn't even say thank you. Or, you know, I went to their daughter's wedding. Where are they at mine? You know, where's my casserole when I'm sick, you know, or whatever. Well, then we're back to the transaction, right? We're back to you're giving to get something in return. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not love. That's not love. And how much better does it feel to give to somebody and they don't even know you're giving it, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you can't have expectations when you give and they have no idea that you're giving it. But to have no expectations, to show love that is kind with zero expectations, that's love. That's what love is.
And actually, it's like almost clicking exactly what you're saying for me. I struggle with Christmas and that word transactional keeps coming up in my mind, that it's a transactional gift for anybody, you know? And I think exactly what you're saying, some of the most meaningful, memorable gifts that I've received have not had an expectation that there was a gift in return, or they've been unexpected. And so, you know, I'm going to a tangible gift, but that's the same thing even with words too, compliments that we remember, positive words people have said to us just because they've said it. And I know I will admit I'm also left-handed. Compliments for me are very hard to receive and to give, honestly. But as I was learning how to accept compliments, I always kind of grew up with this in my mind of when someone gives me a compliment, I need to give them one in return immediately as they're saying it, just to make it equal. And exactly what you're saying of like, love is kind and love is patient and love is just to just be loving towards somebody without that expectation in return just makes a lot of sense. So for me, things are clicking together as you're talking today. And I love it. I just think it's really, really good for people to hear that and to know that. Because a lot of things fall apart because of unmet expectations. Mm. You know, that night that you had with your husband kind of fell apart because you had an expectation that he didn't meet. And so relationships, marriages, friendships, jobs, you know, parents to children. I mean, everything there is so expectation driven, transactional driven, that if we were to just open our hearts to just love and just love and love and love, which is what we're biblically called to do, is just to love God and love others. And that's all, that's our command from God to do that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing, you know, there's nowhere in the Bible that it says like love and expect love back. You're just not going to get it in all circumstances. So I think it's great.
Another word that's coming up to mind right now too is speaking of expectation and boundaries. And I was listening to, and at the moment, I cannot remember exactly who was speaking at the moment, but they were saying that good boundaries are biblical and good communicating your expectations and communicating your boundaries, that's actually a way of loving other people in a way, because then that's clarifying too, because not only unmet but unspoken expectations and unspoken intentions, that's withholding. And if we want to be open and loving, we need to love others by sharing our boundaries. And so I, in doing a little bit of research on you, I found that you have a slew of kids. And so you have quite a hefty handful of people who expect love from you, and you have lots of love to give, and you have, it seems like a very big family, but every single person has a cup and that gets empty and runs dry sometimes. And so what are the things that you are able to do in order to fill your cup so that you can keep on pouring out onto the entire world, honestly?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think One thing that I do that might sound a little crazy, but it might be something you want to try, is self-love is so important. You know, sometimes we feel like it's getting overused, you know, or whatever, and it's kind of said differently. But the Bible also says, love yourself. Love God, love yourself, and love others, right? You need to love yourself. But going back to that appreciation of who you are, your uniqueness. And so I started this thing where at night, right before I go to bed, I look in the mirror and I tell myself something I did good that day. Hmm. I tell myself something that I resisted, that like a temptation that I resisted that day. Hmm. And then I finish with, I love you. Hmm. And it's a good practice. Like it's kind of weird at first to tell yourself, to look yourself in the eye and say, I love you. And I appreciate you, because you're talking about things you appreciate, right? But
that does sound very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it is. It is. But after a few days,
yeah,
it's not so much anymore. And it's it fills you up. It fills you up. If you've not heard it from anybody else that day, you get to hear it from you.
Sure.
And there are so many occasions where everybody has negative self-talk, just to have to end your day on a positive comment to yourself from yourself. That's a nice way to just say, getting all the negativity out and just letting the love in and letting it swirl around in your dreams as you sleep at night. Yeah, just ending the day on such a great note.
And it makes lovely. So much sense. Why? I'm a mom. I have an almost 6-year-old daughter, and I have heard that you are supposed to speak positively to them at the end, because their brain will do something. I'm not sure all of the actual science behind it, but what I've heard is when you speak positively at the end of their day, at the end of their night, they're going to sleep, and you speak like, I'm proud of you. I love you. You're beautiful. You've done a great job today. You're a great listener. You're a great friend. And you speak that into them. They remember that. And it's something that processes within them that's really what they start to believe is what they're told at the end of their day, which is so interesting. Mm-hmm. And so it makes complete sense exactly what you're saying to us as adult humans. That when we speak those positive words to ourselves, our brain starts to see that and hear that and start to believe it, honestly. So it makes complete sense what you're sharing, even if it's the most uncomfortable thing that you can do.
Well, you can do it without anybody else in the room.
Right.
Make sure you're completely alone.
Right. No one's in the room. Your makeup's not done. Your hair's a mess. You brush your teeth. You know, you've got acne here, there, whatever, like, and you just look at yourself in the mirror and you just say, I love you. And in a way, I'm sure that makes God smile, because he's seeing that you're seeing the value that he sees in you.
Yeah, and so true.
That's really beautiful. I love that.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. You know, I think about like, if you loved apple pie, like it's your favorite thing in the world, apple pie, and somebody presents you with the best ever apple pie, right? The greatest apple pie. And they've made it from scratch. They made the crust, they made everything. Not only that, but they grew the apples that went into the apple pie, that they peeled all those apples. They grew those apples. They made the dirt that helped those apples grow. They created that completely, everything about it. They made the flour. They made the wheat that made the flour that went into this beautiful apple pie. And if you were to say, oh, you know what? No, thank you. I don't like it. It's not very pretty. It does not look tasty. What a slap in the face, right?
Right.
Like, how devastating is that when we throw it back? And that's God who created you and gave you this beautiful vessel to live in and this beautiful life. If you diss yourself, you're saying, you know what, God, you did okay with them, but you didn't do so great with me. Well, no, God did great with you. And yeah. So I like how you said that. That's so true. Yeah.
God, yeah, you are worthy of being loved. Everybody's worthy of being loved. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And love is all of the things that you've talked about throughout this whole podcast, which I love.
How many times can we use the word love? I'm going to be much more aware of my use of the word all day now.
you brought it up.
So I wish we had more time to talk specifically about your work in Haiti and your year long, you say your year plus long experiment. But my, I guess the one question that I will ask about it is, how did you track or gauge how the experiment was going? Did you journal? Did you do a video log? Did you have the same thing that you would do every day? Or were you just noticing different changes in how you were processing things? Are you able to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I worked on one word a month and really focused on, you know, one word a month. So, you know, love is patient was the first one. Mm-hmm. And I just was love is patient, and just looked for it everywhere. Mm-hmm. But every single month, without fail, every single month, every single 14, there's 14 isses and isn'ts of love in that chapter. And every single month, it took me until the very end of the month to go, oh, now I get it. And it would take some big dramatic happening. Like I was chased by a motorcycle gang. I got lost on a mile high mountain with a med student in the dark. I slept outside with tarantulas and chupacabras and snakes or whatever is lurking in the bushes of Haiti. I had all these crazy experiences that then I go, oh, finally, finally, now I understand what that means. Mm-hmm. And yes, and I was writing the whole time. I was doing it. Mm-hmm.
I think love is patient. Man, that's a hard one to start with. I think that would be the most challenging one for me for sure. So having was that, did you go in order?
I did accept one.
Okay.
I was kind of afraid of love keeps no record of wrongs. Mm-hmm. Because I thought, well, you know, you might forgive somebody, but you don't forget the things that happened to you. Mm-hmm. So right. What could that possibly mean? And that month, oh my gosh, if we had time, I would tell you the story of what happened that month. It was crazy, crazy, and came to the realization of what that truly means.
Wow. Hmm. I love that. That's really amazing to live that and to so intentionally discover what that passage means and what encompasses love, really. And I think we can all learn from that, I would say. So how can we find your book? Where can we find it? And just tell us how we can resource ourselves with all of the knowledge and experience that you've gained.
Yeah, well, my book is on Amazon. It's in brick and mortar stores. It's called Love Is. It's such a simple title. Big Love Is on the cover of the book. So it's pretty easy to find. So it's available everywhere. My name, Kim Sorrell. My last name, I'm literally the only Kim Sorrell spelled my way in the entire world because my last name is ridiculous. It has two R's, two L's, two E's. I have no idea why. But it's Sorrelle, kimsorrelle.com is my website. But you can also get there, loveis.info. You can get to my website by typing in loveis.info. And I'm all over social media, so I am easy to find because my name is unique. And I love hearing from people. I have a free 14-day love challenge on my website. Mm-hmm. If all you have to do is sign up for it, and it's easy and interesting. It's just a different aspect of love every day that you kind of think about. Mm. And if you do sign up for it, I will send you for free a WWLD, what would love do, wristband. Because if you can answer any question that way, then you know you're doing the right thing.
That's beautiful. I love that. I love that.
And I appreciate the allusion to the old cloth WWJD because Jesus is love. And so replacing those two words are just so logical.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, and Jesus is different to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Even to Christians, you know, he can be different. And mm-hmm. but love is universal. Mm-hmm. Any religion, any non-religion, any mm-hmm. country, any anywhere.
Sorry. The puppy made an appearance. So for those that are watching us on YouTube, you will get to see the cute new puppy in the background.
Yeah, he's so cute.
Our last question for you, Mandy and I are, as our listeners know, both music therapists. And so we understand the transformative power that music can have in our life. And we ask if you have a certain song that reminds you of a certain part of your journey, a certain song that was pivotal, one that you always go to when you feel like you need love or you want to express love. Is there one song Sometimes I pick two because I can never make a decision. But is there a song or an artist that you would like to share with our listener that we can add to our playlist so that when people listen to your story, they can also listen to the song that was transformative to you and get to know you a little bit better?
Yes, absolutely. There was one song and it's All You Need Is Love. Love is all you need. All you need is love.
By the Beatles, the original? You're talking the original?
The original, the Beatles, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. Because you need... I need to be reminded. I think sometimes people need to be reminded that when you feel like you're lacking in some area of your life or whatever, that really all you need is love. That's mm-hmm. all you need.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think just love and care, and exactly like you said, giving that and experiencing love and being able to give that back to others is so rewarding, and it's so healing, and it just helps with so many aspects of our life. And you know, I think it's a great reminder to remind ourselves each day that we can love ourselves, not in a boastful or prideful way, in a very humble way, but recognizing who we are and who we were created to be. I think that's wonderful. And loving each other. If more people in the world would do that, life would just be so much better, right?
The world would be a different place.
The world would definitely be a different place.
For sure.
So I love that. Love the Beatles. Closet fan. And so I think that's a great choice. I was actually thinking you were going to pick the Nat King Cole L-O-V-E song, the old one, like the dancing one. I don't know. That was like the first love song that came into my head. But I remember that one from The Parent Trap.
So. Right. Oh my gosh. But, so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. We would love to chat with you more sometime, have you come back and share more of your journey in Haiti. And, you know, we'll just keep in touch and see where things go. But we just really are grateful for it. And thank you for sharing so much today and just being so open and vulnerable with us. A slew of emotions, from just really heavy sadness and grief to joy and love, honestly, of just who you are. And just, you know, spending some time with you, you really do exemplify that, and you're an inspiration to a lot of people, I'm sure. So just be encouraged by that, and we're grateful for you. We thank all of our listeners and hope you enjoyed chatting with Kim today. We'll talk to you soon.